Alright, alright. You're now listening to Truth Refuge Radio, and I am your host, Chris Lazar, and I am joined in the studio with my friend Landon Webb. Say hello to the people, Landon. Alright, so today is November 21st, 2013, and we have a whole handful of stories to go through today. So we're going to try and make it quick. So first, we're going to go ahead and get started with Edward Snowden news. Now, Edward Snowden, as we all remember, is the NSA or former NSA whistleblower who has a whole host of secret documents that he is releasing. He is now held up in Russia because his passport was suspended by the U.S. government. So we're going to go ahead and see what Mr. Snowden has revealed. Now, according to The Guardian, this is yesterday, according to The Guardian, in 2007, American and British intelligence agencies agreed to a deal that allowed the NSA to store the personal data of British citizens, according to documents obtained by Snowden. The data is being stored so it can be accessed by the American intelligence agencies and their military. Part of the Five Eyes partnership, which includes the countries of the United States, Canada, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand, I'm not sure how New Zealand got in there, agreed not to spy on each other's citizens. So these were the rules that were happened to be changed in 2007, which allowed the NSA to gather intelligence on British civilians. The data collected was quote-unquote incidental, meaning that the information collected by the NSA were of individuals who weren't doing anything wrong or subject to any prior surveillance. So they were essentially innocent civilians minding their own business. The data was being collected for a practice the NSA called three-hopping. Three-hopping means that the NSA would store this information so they could gather information on a friend of a friend of a friend. Basically, three hops. So for a typical Facebook user, the three hop method could allow the NSA to pull up to 5 million users alone. In a separate memo revealed, the United States had a method to conduct surveillance on citizens of the Five Eyes, even though the government or their governments explicitly agreed not to do so. So this is where we are right now. Can anybody trust us, Landon?
I'm not sure that they really care that much, actually.
Being the United States.
It's hard to say these specific countries in the new revelations, but I know that Germany, they've been outraged recently because they found out that the NSA was tapping the chancellor's phone. And I think a lot of the response from Germany is just manufactured outrage, basically, for domestic political purposes.
Right.
But in the end, I don't think the government of Germany really cares that much.
You really think they don't
because
care?
Because they get intelligence from the U.S. And I'm not sure it really even undermines their power anyway. I mean, they're kind of in a subordinate relationship in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, there was a joke on The Daily Show saying, really, Germany, you can't expect us not to spy on you. But I don't really buy that. I see it as a problem only because they are our friends. And I can only imagine what's happening with China. I mean, how do you think our surveillance powers are spread out all over China? And that's a quote-unquote frenemy. So I'm not sure if any of these people could trust us. And maybe you're right. Maybe they don't even care. I'm not sure where this kind of leads us. But just like you said, this is following recent revelations of our spying in Germany, including and France and Spain. And they've recently gathered a group of these ambassadors to discuss our spying policy. I wonder. Well, obviously, the president said he had no idea that this was happening.
Well,
right?
Maybe the British leaders actually knew it was happening all along, but they only wanted their people to think that they made sure the U.S. wasn't spying on them. And at the same time, I would say that if it was an actual deception on the part of the U.S. government, then we have to assume that their domestic spying operations are a lot more extensive than we think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for them to say that they're not spying on U.S. citizens, I think Edward Snowden's documents are pretty, you know, flat, you know, debunk that myth. They are spying on citizens. Now we have to wonder, is the content being analyzed at such an extent where I know they have the capabilities of doing so, but is everybody kind of getting their content monitored? This is no longer a fringe conspiracy theory. This is reality. And I think Edward Snowden, even though he got a lot of crap in the beginning for it, I think he should actually be praised for these revelations. At the very least, he's showing us what's going on. And these documents are dated. I mean, we're talking about 2005, 2007. Obviously, they carry on to present day. But this is stuff that was happening under the Bush administration, which continues under the Obama administration. So I wonder where that leaves us with our... with our intelligence. How do you think the public views Snowden now?
That's hard to say, actually. Because, I mean, there's no doubt that it's not good for national security for people to be releasing secrets like this. On the other hand, it's necessary for there to be whistleblowers and whistleblower protection. So I think the public is divided on the issue.
Yeah, the last study I saw, which was at the beginning of August, I believe, or maybe a little bit later, said that most of the Americans, according to a Quinnipiac poll, had a favorable view of Snowden. And surprisingly, the only subgroup that didn't have a favorable view of Snowden were African Americans. I don't know why that is. We've had a history of spy programs dismantling black nationalist organizations like the Panthers, to the NAACP, to the civil rights movements and things of that nature. So I'm not sure why the African-Americans would be so skeptical of Edward Snowden. Now, I mind you that it wasn't a large margin. I believe it was like 46, 47 in favor and not in favor. I think that we should have a favorable view of Snowden. I don't think, at the very least, I don't think that he should be demonized the way that he is. I think he has revealed a lot of information that is useful. And from here on out, I think he's not lying. I mean, these aren't eccentric tales. I, you know, think whatever is in the sky that he has proof to back these claims. They're no longer just, like I said, these radical conspiracy theories. These are actual documentation that he's releasing to The Guardian and other newspapers. Any last thoughts on Snowden and this information that was revealed?
It reminds me of WikiLeaks a lot.
Yeah, it definitely does. And as a matter of fact, last week, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks released the Pacific Trade Agreement, a chapter in the Pacific Trade Agreement. We could probably go over that next week because I have to go back and look over everything. So we'll cover that for you next week because I think that has a lot to do with corporate influence on governments and how they are trying to bring more free trade, which comes at the cost and the expense of American jobs. So now we're going to go ahead and move on to Afghanistan news. United States and Afghanistan have reached an agreement that would leave troops in the war-torn country after 2014. The bilateral security agreement states that U.S. soldiers will remain to train roughly 350,000 Afghani troops. American troops will cease military action unless mutually agreed upon with Afghan forces, meaning the Afghan troops will basically be carrying out actions against the Taliban, and if they need the United States help, they'll ask for the United States help, but it has to be a mutual agreement. So will this help conflict in Afghanistan? I don't necessarily think so. We have to remember that the Taliban said they will not stop attacking until foreign boots are off their ground. In addition, the agreement didn't cover the use of drones, and the State Department, get this, the State Department also said they will not be apologizing for any of their mistakes. during the 12-year war. So all those random killings, kicking down people's houses, the State Department said, sorry, but we're not sorry. What do you make of this agreement?
Well, I think it's really important and necessary because the the most important aspect of, like, basically making it so the war in Afghanistan wasn't pointless is to establish a strong Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police Force. Because without that, it would be true that when the U.S. pulls out, the Taliban would just take over and everything would have been for nothing. And so the thing is, right now, at least, the Afghan National Army is a complete joke, basically.
Right.
Something like 20-30% literacy rate, which wouldn't be a problem, except most of them speak different languages anyway.
Right.
So they can't communicate either verbally or in written orders. And there's huge ethnic divides between Pashtuns and Tajiks and all different ethnicities because Afghanistan was created by arbitrary imperial borders. And at the same time, they have a really high desertion rate. Basically, the Afghans just show up, get paid, and leave. I think it was like almost like a 50% desertion rate or something.
That's
like that.
That's insane.
or at least it used to be. Maybe not anymore. But the point is, if the only role that the U.S. military really needs to do is to train the Afghan National Army, and so it's going to take a few more years for them to do that.
So you don't have a problem with them staying?
Not in a non-combat role.
Not in a combat role. All right, so now the question is, can this be considered a victory for the president who said the war will end in 2014? Troops will be back. I mean, I think when he said that, people were expecting something like an Iraq where we're completely out. Because that's what I was expecting.
If we didn't do this, then it would have been a defeat for Obama, at least in the long term. I don't know how long it would have taken for the Taliban to overthrow Karzai's government. Probably not that long, though.
No, probably not.
Considering that not too many people in Afghanistan even see that as a legitimate government.
Right.
So they need to develop a way to use force against their people, actually.
We're not advocating force.
And keep themselves in power, because if not, there's going to be no order other than the Taliban.
So here we are. We just advocated for force on Truth Refuge against the Afghan people. So Karzai is not one to be trusted in the first place. I mean, his people shouldn't trust him. We shouldn't trust him. I think the only people that trust him, if even, are the CIA, who brings him garbage bags full of money.
Yeah, I mean, the level of corruption in Afghanistan, I mean, it's not the U.S.'s job to fix Afghanistan, and they're going to have to do it themselves. Just because, like, the U.S. doesn't even know what to do in Afghanistan.
No. So, I mean, like, what are we doing then? I mean, honestly, the bilateral security agreement is an open-ended question. I mean, who knows how long we're going to have troops there? Who knows what type of force that we could use? They didn't address the issue of drones, the basing of drones, so they could attack in Pakistan.
Well, already combat operations are mostly over. Like, even months ago, they stopped responding to attacks. The U.S. military, they have the Afghans respond now, even though they're mostly incompetent at this point.
Right.
And and the big thing, though, is that the U.S. government has no legitimacy there. Forget about the Afghan government, but the U.S. government, them being there actually makes it worse. I mean, I don't trust the Taliban when they say they'll stop fighting as soon as we leave, because that's obvious. Here's the thing. You really can't trust anybody in Afghanistan. they require bribes for everything, pretty much. The only way the U.S. military is able to supply themselves is, like, the way it works is we pay the Taliban to stop attacking us while we build a road. And then as soon as we've built the road, they blow it up, and then the process goes over again. And we just have to keep doing that. And we've started having to airlift supplies in, even gasoline at a huge cost.
They're participating in Middle Eastern capitalism.
Yeah. And then you look at like the narcotic situation and the fact that 90% of the world's opium or heroin is produced in Afghanistan.
Not to mention big ties with Karzai as well.
And the U.S. military actually allows that completely. Then they protect the poppy fields at some point, because if they didn't do that, then there would be a huge uprising against the U.S. military. And the fact is, the main reason most of the insurgency is in the Taliban. Only like 10% of the fighters are actually what you'd call Taliban, and the others are just fighting for warlords. And the main reason they're fighting is because it's more of like an honor thing, and they just don't want the U.S. there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an occupying force. I think every occupation is going to have a resistance. And at a certain level, I mean, you have to understand where they're coming from. I'm not condoning their acts of terrorism against civilian populations, but you cannot. I don't trust the Taliban when they say that if we leave, they'll stop doing whatever it is that they're doing, obviously. But we are our occupation, our presence there serves as a recruiting tool.
No, I think at the very least. I don't trust the Taliban either, but I think violence will go way down as soon as the U.S. leaves.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I don't think that they'll stop, but I definitely think the violence at the very least will cease. Maybe they'll overthrow the Karzai government. Maybe 350,000 troops is a lot. I'm not sure the Taliban has that many people there. I mean, you also have to deal with the warlords, but I mean, it's nothing. We're wasting our time. Training 350,000 troops is wasting time, because even when we leave in 10 years, it's going to be the same crap hole that it was 10 years ago or 12 years ago before we got involved in the situation.
There's two ways of looking at it, because Obama's plan for Afghanistan, which I think he enacted in 2009 with his surge of 30,000 troops, or maybe it was 2010, but the point was that he was going to have this surge and then hand over control to the Afghans. And so it actually wouldn't have been so bad if there wasn't a surge and then we left and everything went to crap, basically.
Yeah.
But now that we're even more invested in Afghanistan, we have to stay longer, which has always been the problem, because I mean, like, the question is, should we cut our losses and acknowledge that all those troops and money were spent for nothing?
Which it was.
Or should we keep going and possibly waste more lives and money?
I mean, that's exactly. Eventually, we're going to have to cut our losses. Eventually. It's either now or later.
And so the thing is, on the one hand, you could say maybe this plan is going to work. And this is what's necessary. And then on the other hand, you see that it's almost pointless, because the Afghan National Army is so deficient that there's not much we could do.
No, it's not even just the National Army that is deficient. We're talking about just the country as a whole. Just like you said, it was put together by imperialist forces. We have so many deep divisions. People in the army don't even speak the same language. You have warlords. It's not only the Taliban you have to worry about. So even hypothetically, if you come to an agreement with the Taliban, some type of peace agreement, you're still going to have countless numbers of warlords who are instigating fights, trying to get bribes. I mean, the country is just in a terrible condition that I think we're wasting our time. And if we're not going to cut our losses now, we're going to eventually have to cut our losses later. I mean, Iraq isn't a success story, but it's definitely going to be more of a success story than Afghanistan was.
Well, the thing about Iraq is they may have had like practically a civil war for like most of the past 10 years, but they at least did have relatively strong institutions a strong government before that for a long time. Whereas Afghanistan has just been in a constant state of war and disorder for like the past more than 30 years.
Yeah, yeah, more
since
than
1979
that.
At least.
Yeah. So, I mean, who knows where we'll go from here. All right, so we're going to go ahead and take a quick music break, and we'll be back. And we're back. This is Truth Refuge Radio. So we're going to go ahead and speak some more about carbon emissions. Now, there was a recent study that is going to be published in the Journal of Climate Change. And according to this study, nearly two-thirds of carbon emissions since the industrial age have been emitted by 90 firms. Only 90 firms have emitted since the dawn of the industrial age about two-thirds of the carbon emissions. This is insane. So you might know some of these firms, which include the likes of Chevron, Exxon, and BP. In addition, the study lists several state and government-owned firms which produce oil and coal, producing countries like Poland, China, and the Soviet Union. Half of the estimated emissions came from just the past 25 years. This study is insane. As expected, at the recent Warsaw conference, which we covered last week, there are arguments about who's to blame for the rising carbon emissions. I don't even care who's to blame. Well, we just need to do something at this point. This finger pointing is wasting too much time, and it's about time that we act. So we spoke a little bit about this last week. So what interests do companies and state actors have to protect? Or is this just purely a question of what is more profitable?
Well, that number doesn't surprise me at all, because most companies, I would think, don't have too much in the way of carbon emissions, like any given hospital or restaurant or warehouse or anything. Maybe in terms of heating costs, yeah. but that's pretty much all I can think of. And and then when you look at, like, one of the most intensive when it comes to carbon emissions would be concrete producers and things like that. And so this doesn't surprise me, but I don't. What this makes me think of whether or not cap and trade would be a viable solution, considering that these minority of firms would need to buy up all the carbon credits, basically. And which kind of makes it seem like cap and trade wouldn't work. Because the vast majority of companies don't need their carbon credits at all. They would
so
all
they
willingly sell them.
Yeah.
And then these firms that do need them would have way more than they actually
need. And not to mention, I mean, we're only talking about the cap and trade that is applied in the national standard, United States. We still have state actors, and we still have international oil firms and gas giants or whatnot that still produce large numbers of carbon emissions. And to me, I guess it might not be that surprising, but I never thought of the number being so low. I mean, we're talking about since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. We're talking about over 100 years now. Only 90 firms have contributed to about 60% of carbon emissions. And 25%, or I'm sorry, not 25%, half of those came in the last 25 years. to me, that when you actually see it on paper, that is what's most staggering.
Yeah, and most of that is probably from developing countries where population growth and economic growth has exploded over the past few decades. And so that's the biggest challenge when it comes to global warming. I mean, at least like rich countries, whether or not you can find the support for measures against climate change, that's one question, but they can do it. Like the United States can afford to lower carbon emissions. It wouldn't really hamper the economy that much.
No.
But to tell these developing countries that only have access to inefficient forms of like transport or energy production or anything like that, telling them to reduce carbon emissions, it would be telling them basically to stop developing and to stay impoverished. And that's just not
unacceptable.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I agree with that premise. I think that it would be difficult to tell these people. I mean, in all honesty, I mean, if we were to heavily invest and actually have a plan to get away from oil and coal and all these other high forms of carbon emissions, perhaps we could create some type of efficient, low-costing energy supply that we could actually export. And that would be something that we could lead the world in. But when we kind of hang our hat on what we're doing now and say, okay, well, alternative energy is a joke, or green energy is a scam, or even if we are going to invest in these type of technologies, we're not going to do it, you know, we're not going to put the pedal to the metal, so to speak, we're going to have this problem. So, I mean, I don't know where this leaves us. I just thought this was an interesting study that I thought we should discuss here. So next story we're going to go to is McDonald's, America's favorite fast food and probably international fast food. McDonald's could be kind of yummy, definitely their French fries. But what they've been doing as of late, what I guess they've been doing this for quite some time, but what has been revealed as of late is kind of disgusting. So McDonald's McResource website gives a bunch of helpful tips to their workers, like taking a vacation can alleviate stress. Really? So on my $7.50, well, first I should say McResource is a website to help their McWorkers. So on this website, they give a bunch of little helpful tips. So like I said earlier, one of their tips is a vacation can alleviate stress. Really? So you mean to tell me you'll pay me $7.50 where I can't even pay the lights and put food on the table? You're going to tell me to take a stress break by taking a vacation? You've got to be kidding me. That's laughable, right? Okay, so this is all true, by the way. This isn't an onion piece. This is true. How about this one? Breaking your food can help you eat less and feel full. They're telling you to ration in your home.
They should tell you to start putting sawdust in your
bread. or MSG. They're telling you to ration your food in your house, and it'll help you eat less, so it'll help all you fatties. That's not my... that's not what I'm saying. This is what McDonald's is saying, right? And it'll help you feel full. Right. So now you're telling your workers to ration their food. Okay, so I have an even better one. How about selling your gifts that you get on the holidays on eBay? So, you know, all those gifts, or that sweater from grandma or whatnot, or that coffee pot that you have 10 of already. You should package those, sell them off, and they'll help alleviate your holiday debt. And here is my favorite one. The caption of this helpful tip says, "Quit complaining." And here's what it goes on to say. After 10 minutes of complaining, your stress levels rise 15%. Guys, this is not an onion piece. This is happening on the McResource website. You can check it out for yourself. There's an article on Addicting Info that speaks about it. It shows you the video. It shows you screenshots of the link. Landon, take us out with this one.
Yeah. Next thing you know, they're going to be recommending that their employees start selling their organs for extra money. And this, they've been doing this for a while. Like they gave they gave out an example of how their employees should budget their finances.
Yeah.
A while ago, and
that was with the partnership with Visa.
Yeah, and there was no money allotted for healthcare, for example.
Oh yeah, it was like $10 to healthcare. Yeah.
It was just impossible. No one could get coverage for that amount.
You can't
money
buy
month.
Two Big Mac meals for $10. How are you supposed to afford some type of health care? Not to mention that plan that you're talking about expected them to have two jobs. If you look at it closely, it expects them to have two jobs. I actually wrote something on this on Addicting Info. You could go and check that out as well. It's absolutely hilarious. And another revelation that came out a few weeks ago, this is part of the article that I wrote about. A lady called saying that I need help. The lady said, the lady on the other line of the McResource line said, have you heard of SNAP? Have you heard of Medicaid? Have you heard of CHIP? All these are programs that the federal government has that can help people like you. Excuse me, I work 40 plus hours and you're going to tell me to go to the federal government? Cost $7 billion to the taxpayer. So that's that. Those are some helpful hints, not only for people at McDonald's. I mean, anybody who's making minimum wage who are listening out there at FAU or on the interweb. Yeah, just split your food, ration. That's going to help you eat less and you'll feel full, believe it or not, and drink a lot of water. You definitely want to drink a lot of water. And I'll be looking for your gifts on eBay. And remember, always take a vacation. And the number one thing, quit complaining about your job. Your poverty issues are not an issue to complain about. So that's going to go ahead and wrap up this segment. We're going to go ahead to a quick music break. And I'll be back with the monologue of truth. All right, and we're back with Truth Refuge Radio. I am your host, Chris Lazar, and this is our closing segment that I like to call the Monologue of Truth, where I discuss my opinions from the last week that just passed us and some issues that have occurred. So this week I'm going to be talking about the city council election in Seattle. Now you probably wonder, why am I talking about a city council election? And I'm going to go ahead and tell you. So Seattle has recently elected an outspoken socialist to represent them on the city council. Shama Sawant's victory, even at such a low level, proves the growing discontent from the left in the United States is growing. Socialists all around the United States have celebrated her victory as a positive step in the right direction. However, leftists have a lot of ground to make up since their glory days of the early 1900s. Socialist and communist movements alike have been systematically destroyed by the state and the corporate elite. When anyone mentions either of the two, Americans tend to flinch and reject their philosophies. However, times have changed. Socialism is no longer a dirty word among the youth, thanks to Occupy and other dissident movements of the kind. The ideals of Marxism and other collectivist movements are becoming more prominent in political discourse. Obviously, in the mainstream political consciousness, socialism, communism, and Marxism still carry a negative connotation. They're usually used as bad words to describe Democrats and liberals. Even prominent Democrats and liberals reject the central tenets of socialism. They would much rather opt out for market-based solutions and limited regulations on certain industries, perhaps like oil and banking. Nevertheless, that is fine. Alternative leftist movements are gaining traction in local elections, what I would consider to be true grassroots movements, the voice of the people. With the recent success of reactionary right-wing political actors, it is time for the radical left to come out and face this threat head-on. Their plans to roll back regulations, free the markets, cut social programs, and privatize essentially everything pose a grave threat to the middle and lower classes in the name of profit. Granted, leftists have a long way to go considering the recent success of the Tea Party, but Savant's victory proves that socialists shouldn't be afraid to be outspoken and afraid to run in elections. However, starting at the local level and making changes in the community is the best course of action at this time. If we can help the community first, it would hopefully alleviate the irrational fears of socialism and other growing leftist movements. Again, we have a long way to go, but with the growing discontent in America, in American political culture, this makes our future look strong. All right, so this is all I have for you guys today. So make sure you check out the Facebook pages, Truth Refuge Radio, and The Opinionated Leftist. I also write for Addicting Info, which you can find at addictinginfo.org. And you can follow me on Twitter at CLazare24. That's CLazare24. We won't be in the studio next week since it is Indian Genocide Celebration Day, or as many would call it, Thanksgiving. Thanks for listening, and remember, always seek the truth.
Different radical leftist organizations, including the Africans Fighting Racism and Oppression, or AFRO, if you will, the Black Revolutionary Organization, or BRO, and also the Black Revolutionary Underground Heroes.
I used to run with a clan that was militant. Preparing for war, we studied strategies with diligence. The revolution was our real intent. We had to put our theory to work so we could find out what it really meant. I used to run with a clan that was militant. Preparing for war, we studied strategies with diligence. The revolution was our real intent. We had to put our theory to work so we could find out. I used to run with a clan that was militant. Preparing for war, we studied strategies with diligence. The revolution was our real intent. We had to put our theory to work so we could find out what it really meant. Then I was sent to Chicago, Illinois, the place where the most Black Panthers were destroyed. You either push dope, lock down, or unemployed. Hearing shots late at night keep the people paranoid.
Have you ever read Seize the Time? I read it when I was 16 and it freed my mind. Coming up on the dirty South Florida roads, being exposed to the Panther code, make me a soldier, a child of the 10-point platform in rap form. Word to the Suey P tatted on my left arm. It's for life, cause if it wasn't for the Panthers, the real OGs like Kapoor and Fred Hampton and Comrade on the West Coast side of Watts, East Coast, BLA returning shots at cops. There wouldn't be no free school lunches. It was Matulu Shakur that gave us acupuncture to cure the junkies.
Black vests, Afros, troopers, and black gloves. 5-point programs, rifles, and black love. Panthers holding it tight like black hugs. All the black ears who call them with black rugs. Black fists, Afros, troopers, and black gloves. 5-point programs, rifles, and black love. Panthers holding it tight like black hugs. All their black ears who call them with black rugs. It's the Panthers.
The Panthers yawning, the rhythm and blues. Conservative smiles on the 5 o'clock news. Here comes Bush, here comes the ground. Here comes the fury, here comes the sound. Hitmen for America with contracts to kill. Right-wing fantasies on a liberal thrill. Debates the deals and media leaks. They get the talk shows and we get the freaks. Neighborhood jails for neighborhood crimes. Family and friends drop neighborhood dimes. No public TV, no public opinion. Total oppression over total dominion. The real design, the ultimate plan. Confusion becomes God and God becomes man.
Black fists, apples, cookies, and black gloves. 5-point programs, rifles, and black love. Panthers holding it tight like black hugs. All the black ears who call them with black rugs. Black fists, apples, cookies, and black gloves. 5-point programs, rifles, and black love. Panthers holding it tight like black hugs. All the black ears who call them with black rugs.
I'm the